The 559 meeting of Security Council is in order. My government has decided to bring their dispute with the Iranian government on the subject of the termination of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company's concession to the urgent attention of the Security Council, because they believe that as a good and loyal member of the United Nations, this is the only course that the United Kingdom can take at the present time. No one can doubt the essentially inflammatory nature of a situation of the kind which now exists in those parts of Iran which are affected.
So this is a kind of whirlwind tour through modern Iranian history, from sort of the late 19th century through to, like, I guess I'm going to go up to after the revolution or just after the revolution. My name is Eskander Sadiq Burjerdi, and I'm currently a British Academy postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Oxford, where I also obtained my doctorate. And my main sort of area of interest is modern Iran, the history of modern Iran. And then if you want me to kind of elaborate on the post-revolutionary period, then I can do that as well. From the late 19th century, I mean, we see various critiques of sort of absolutist monarchy, the absolutist monarchy of the Qajar dynasty. And this is, I mean, there are obviously European influences in this regard. I mean, looking to the French Revolution and whatnot, but also looking to the example of the reforms underway in the Ottoman Empire, the Tanzimat. So we see in this period, various intellectuals, obviously comprising a small literate elite, as it were, calling for significant reforms of the Qajar dynasty. And obviously some are far more radical and some are much more, you could say, reformist in demeanor. Representatives of these currents are famously Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani, or as Iranians call him, Asad Abadi, who is often seen as one of the first figures of pan-Islamism, as it were, but he's also often seen as someone who had a kind of instrumental relationship with Islam, as it were, or to a limited extent. I mean, some people claim this, that he sought to use the whole notion of the Islamic world or the Muslim world and rally Muslims from Egypt, where he was based at one time, also India and elsewhere, and also he was for a period in the Ottoman Empire, obviously, but he's Iranian born and he was a Shia, but using the notion of the Islamic world in order to fight what he saw as that world's kind of imperial subjugation to the imperial order, and particularly obviously the British Empire, who monitored his activities closely. And famously, one of his actually disciples assassinated Nasiruddin Shah.
If you turned into flies, your buzzing would deafen the ears of Great Britain. And if God changed each one of you into a turtle that would cross the sea and surround Great Britain, you could drag its islands to the depths of water and return back to your India being liberated. Sayyid Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani.
So Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani is one sort of representative, a very significant one, an important figure in many respects. He famously had, you know, a series of debates with Ernest Renan, the famous sort of French theoretician of nationalism, amongst other things. Al-Afghani undertook a critique of sort of materialist thought. So you could take this, you could regard this very much as an example of a Muslim thinker responding to the Orientalist critique of his own culture as passive and incapable of self-reflection and, you know, wedded to fatalism and these sorts of things. So Al-Afghani is one of important figure for sure, and who had a massive, you know, impact way beyond Iran's borders. And another example is someone like Malcolm Khan, who was often seen as more of a court intellectual, someone who had a fairly decent at various stages relationship with the court, and famously edited a periodical called Qanun, namely Law, and really was calling for internal reshuffling and reordering of these Qajar monarchy and thought that, you know, the implementation of law writ large, obviously that's quite a capacious notion, but like law writ large would be a means to modernize the Iranian state and Europe was often seen as the horizon of development and evolution, socio-cultural and economic evolution and development, and that was the telos to which Iran should be striving toward. So Malcolm Khan is another, obviously, notable. There's also another figure who's important as well, called Mostashar Dole, who, again, similarly in the late 19th century, wrote a famous tract called Yek Kalame, which had given that one word, and that one word was law. Very much again seeing law as a sort of panacea, which could really address all of these supposed ailments from which Iran suffered. And we should also remember that many of these intellectuals who were both influenced by European and Ottoman ideas at the time and developments did have a quite Eurocentric conception of development and the temporality of development.
If you wish to discover the path of progress by your own intelligence, then we will have to wait for 3,000 years. The Europeans have discovered the path of progress and the principles of order in the course of 3,000 years, just as they have discovered the telegraph, and they have reduced them to one well-defined law. Just as we can introduce the telegraph from Europe and set it up in Tehran without any difficulty, so too we can adopt their principles of ordering the affairs of state. Mirza Malcolm Khan.
So they very much saw law as a universal panacea which might be able to transform the country for the better. And since there's a whole, you know, raft of literature which developed in this direction, which looks at one of the reasons for Iran's failure to become a liberal capitalist democracy is because of the absence of law and the presence of Gekko's arbitrary rule. And this is a quite important historiographical trend in the area of Iranian history. So there's all of these ideas which are circulating around this time. There's a lot of debates. There's similarly debates about sort of Iran's, I guess, linguistic and cultural identity. Obviously, at this point, in the late 19th century, similarly, there are various thinkers like Mirza Agha Khan Kermani and Akhundzadeh, who basically see many of the Iran sort of fundamental problems in it, and they sort of trace this back to the Arab conquests, see Iran estranged from its true identity, and they obviously buy into many of these actually interesting but obviously deeply problematic Orientalist theories and also theories of race which are emerging during this time, and believe Iran's glorious history is to be associated with a racial and linguistic ideal.
Arabs, bare arse, savage, hungry vagabonds. I spit on them, naked bandits, homeless rat eaters, vilest humans, most vicious beasts, camel riding thieves, black and yellow scrawny lot, animal like, and even worse than animals. Mirza Agha Khan Kermani.
One alternative diagnosis of the reasons for Iran's falling apart, and we can see this having an impact later, and this has been covered very well in a colleague of mine's work, Reza Ziya Ibrahimi, done, who sort of addressed this in some detail. Yeah, so there's these various, you could say, responses by the intelligentsia as to why modern Iran hasn't developed along European lines. Obviously, this is very much has to be situated in a broader context. We have to understand that Qajar Iran, obviously the central state, was profoundly weak. This narrative of sort of Islamic decline was very much prevailing both in the literature of Orientalism and then often being taken up and internalized in the Iranian context. And obviously this has a material substrate in the sense that, I mean, Iran was very much dominated, increasingly so throughout the 19th century, and this really does come to a head in the early 20th century. For instance, Iran is badly defeated in the British Afghan War at Herat. It's in really struggling to, you could say, revive or, in scare quotes again, return to its former glories, whether it's pre-Islamic or it's the Safavid era in the 16th and 17th centuries. So Iran is very weak. The central government has a rather tenuous hold on many parts of the country, etc., etc. So many of these sort of responses on the part of the intelligentsia are really responses or trying to figure out why Iran is in such a weak position, why is it dominated by these imperial powers, or it's Tsarist Russia or the British Empire, why, and usually this is framed as sort of why did Iran lag behind while Europe progressed. So they're trying to respond to a genuine problem. Obviously the question is whether their solutions are pertinent, and obviously, you know, at the time they were resorting to those prevailing vernaculars that were available to them and those sort of intellectual trends that were available to them. And obviously, apart from a material sort of economic and military hegemony, which on the part of Europe, obviously there was an ideological one as well, and this was the part of the reason why Iranian intellectuals would turn to that as a model. And sort of a famous figure by the name of Sayyid Hassan Tahrirzadeh, who would become a prominent constitutionalist figure. I mean, he has this quite infamous quote which people always attribute to him, which it's unfair on the one hand because it kind of it's quite a reductive way to approach his legacy in its entirety, but it's nevertheless important. And he's famously said that you know, Iranians should basically become European inside out and just accept everything the Europeans have to offer if they hope to really, you know, emerge out of this period of decay and decline and the rest of it. Yeah, so we basically, these are these two responses, well, these various responses, because Iran is never formally colonized, but it's basically dominated by imperial powers. So it's very much, you know, an issue of neo-colonialism. Okay, so we see towards, obviously at the very beginning of the 20th century, a series of protests and whatnot break out, calling a so-called Edalat Khane, like a house of justice. And to not get too bogged down in the details, this leads to the emergence of Iran's first constitution, and it's being signed off by Mozaffar-ed-Din Shah just before he dies. Brings into being, in principle, so Iran's an Iranian parliament and supposedly a new constitutional order where the monarch would be answerable to law. So the constitutional revolution, as it's often called, between 1905 and 1911. In 1908, Muhammad Ali Shah, who is obviously the new king at this time, with the support of the Russians, bombards the Iranian parliament and murders a whole raft of constitutionalists and establishes what is often referred to as the minor despotism. Another sort of important point in this period is the emergence from the late 19th through to the early 20th century, a huge number of not only Iranian intellectuals, but Iranian artisans, merchants and laborers in Tabriz, in the north of the country, who had, you know, considerable contacts with the Caucasus and with Russia, and many of Iranian laborers throughout the late 19th century went to Baku to work in the oil industry there, which was obviously the main source of oil for the Russian Empire, and then would come back, influenced often by the ideas of Russian social democracy of various stripes. So this is very much also in the offing at this time, and it's important to remember this, because when Muhammad Ali Shah then establishes the minor despotism, particularly in Tabriz but also in various other places, we see the emergence of a huge number of local anjomans, associations, which basically act to once again force the Shah to reinstate the constitution, and this is very much part of a revolutionary struggle, and the various figures, you know, who are sort of the luminaries of this period, the people like Sattar Khan, and there's many, many others. And we should remember that, you know, this was a quite, in many respects, multifaceted coalition, in the sense that they were both people who thought of themselves as social democrats. We see the establishment of the first social democratic party in Iran. We see various senior clergymen also defending the constitutional order and decrying the overturning of the constitution by the monarchy, and also denouncing those clerics which did support Muhammad Ali Shah, particularly one by the name of Fazlullah Nuri, who would later be hanged. And various sort of major tribal leaders like the Bakhtiaris also play a very significant part in reinstating the constitutional order, reinstating the Iranian parliament. So this basically comes about in 1911. I mean, the usual narrative is that Iran at this point is extremely weak. The parliament is largely ineffective. We shouldn't forget that actually the Russian Empire, I think in 1911, if I'm not mistaken, similarly undertakes a huge massacre of constitutionalists in Tabriz, and essentially occupies Tabriz through to the October Revolution. So the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, is not in full control by any means. But we do see sort of the emergence of, you know, the first party system, so the Democrat Party and the so-called sort of moderate party. It's also just worth remembering that Iran in 1907 is essentially divided between the Russian Empire and the British Empire, so the Brits in the south and the Russians in the north. So just to return to my earlier point, we see that the central government in Tehran is weak. There's also a whole, you know, cast of modernist intellectuals who are very much calling for a strongman or a man, the leader that can come to the rescue of Iran and revive again, scare quotes, this strong, powerful Iran and modernize it, very much, I guess, in the mold of people like Ataturk in Turkey. And this obviously eventually comes to pass with the coup of 1921, where we see Zia Tabatabai, Sayed Zia, as he's often known, and Reza Khan, who was, a brigadier general in the Cossack Brigade, which was originally led by Russian officers and was set up at the request of the Qajar monarch, and played a significant role, obviously, even in repressing the constitutionalists. So we see the rise of, we see this coup d'etat, and we see the emergence of this gradually, this strongman in the form of Reza Khan, who then initially was thinking about whether he should proclaim a republic or not, and ultimately, having pushed Sayed Zia aside fairly quickly and gradually monopolizing the reins of power, he crowns himself monarch in 1925. What he does during this time is quickly undertake, you know, a quite radical and violent process of state modernization, so the forced settlement of the tribes. But obviously before even doing that, we should remember as well actually that there are a whole in the 20s, the end of the 1910s, there are a huge number of actually local rebellions in Iran. So from Khorasan to we even have the sort of the brief period of a Soviet Republic of Gilan, headed by Mirza Kuchar Khan, famously, and his group, sort of the Jangelis, the people of the forest. And we also see a whole series of rebellions in Azerbaijan. And these are brutally repressed by Reza Khan, who then obviously, as I said, crowns himself king. And having done that, he undertakes this major project of, you could say, Eurocentric modernization, in the sense that, you know, he very much saw the nation as one which is a strong central state, ethnically homogenous, very much, you know, settled and urbanized along, you know, as you would imagine any other European state, a single language, a single, you know, strong standing army, a national school system. So he sets up, obviously, the University of Tehran, amongst other things. Yeah, this is a quite, you know, builds, obviously, railways and lots of infrastructure, the early stages of industrialization, you could say. But yeah, it's also arguable that a lot of sort of Iran's proto-industrialization in a slightly earlier period had already been undercut by the British Empire. So we see this period of sort of authoritarian modernization on the part of Reza Shah, the outlawing of communism. There had been a communist party which had its first congress in Anzali in 1920 and had been fairly active, towards the end had become ineffective. But yeah, the banning of communism and the repression actually of many of those sort of dissident intellectuals, and even those that had supported him, like some of his closest advisors, like the Minister of Court, Temurtash and others, are killed. But we shall say, yeah, the school system is overhauled, as I said. The legal system is massively overhauled. So we have the removal of Sharia courts and we have their replacement with, civil legal courts and whatnot. So we see a whole, a raft of reforms which undeniably shaped Iran and its future till this day. There is very much still, by certain quarters, an almost cult personality around Reza Shah as this strong man who saved Iran from chaos and backwardness and all these sorts of things. The reality is far more messy and complicated, particularly in light of his authoritarianism, what was seen initially as his approval by, or the approbation of his becoming monarch by the British, etc., etc. But yeah, I mean, his legacy is a complex one, but is undeniably linked to authoritarian coercive modernization, which took this European paradigm and ideal as its lodestar. But yeah, ultimately he is removed in the course of the Second World War. I mean, he was seen as trying to maybe balance that Russian and British influence, who were Iran's sort of traditional imperial foes, as it were, with Germany. And there were, there's lots of work which has been done sort of on the level of German advisors and Berlin radio stations operating in Iran, but it's actually quite often exaggerated. And obviously recent research has actually shown that once the British gave the order that Reza Shah, that he needs to essentially clamp down on German activities in Iran, he very quickly responded. But the British had pretty much, I think, reconciled themselves or had taken the decision to have him removed, and because they wanted to occupy the country to underwrite their, I guess, their supply lines and these sorts of things.
This is the Gaumont British News, presenting the world to the world. Oil refineries at Abadan, in the land that used to be called Persia. Vital strategic country between Iraq and the Soviet Union. One of the richest oil fields in the world. In early August 1941, all but in the grip of Hitler through his famous troop of foreign tourists. Now, by swift action by the British Empire and the Soviet, snatched from the enemy's hands. In late August, tanks of the Empire armies moved into Iran. Troops drawn largely from Indian regiments began the occupation of this land whose ruler, for his own gain, was about to sell his countrymen into Nazi slavery. The occupation was completed quickly, though many still think not quickly enough. And though most people feel that the rounding up of Axis agents should have been carried out much more drastically, this action was at least another instance of Britain getting her blow in first. Pipeline is under guard. Gradually, in this uphill fight, the British Empire is extending her influence. Before we finish this war, the world will know again that Britain means what she says. Life goes on much the same despite the occupation. There was very little resistance. In fact, it's pretty obvious from these pictures that the vast majority of the Iranian people had no desire to collaborate with Nazi Germany. This mighty oil business was developed largely by British brains and British capital. It would have been a rich prize for Hitler. But this was not to be another Romania. Empire intelligence officers chatted with Iranian officers, and in the meantime, the boys got friendly with the local citizens. Once again, there is obviously no resentment at the entry of our troops. These gunboats were part of the Iranian Navy. They made no attempt to hamper the arrival of our forces, who came to clear the Axis agents out of their country. These are other gunboats which attempted to resist at the orders of the Shah, himself under orders from Nazi headquarters. So ends this first installment of DB News Pictures of another chapter of world history, the rescue of a nation too weak to act in its own interest. Congratulations to these men who carried out a delicate task with tact combined with strength. and that disposes of the Shah, who sought to enrich himself at the expense of his fellow countrymen.
So yeah, so in 1941, Iran is occupied, Reza Shah is removed, and exiled to South Africa. The British at this point are mulling over whether they should reinstate the Qajar dynasty or not. One of the princes that was under consideration briefly was actually British educated and couldn't speak Persian, but I think his mother tongue was Azeri. But yeah, he was unable, and he was basically become British, and ultimately it was dismissed, I think, by people like Anthony Eden as being unrealistic because, yeah, he had little idea of the Iranian scene and contact with Iranians, so it was seen as a rather a stretch. So they ultimately oversee the process of Mohammad Reza Shah's instatement as succeeding monarch. So Iran is occupied, but it's actually a quite interesting period of political ferment, and we see the founding of the Tudeh party, the party of the masses in Iran, which is a very important juncture in Iranian political and intellectual history, and we see some very much taking up this whole notion of, you know, the popular front against fascism, but similarly advocating sort of modern, you know, various policies such as land reform, women's rights, women's social rights, greater democratization, etc., which is interesting. And in any event, we see, so Iran is obviously occupied throughout the war. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi at this point is still relatively weak. In 1946, there is something by the name of the so-called Azerbaijan crisis, where Soviet Republic Azerbaijan is established within Iran and who's led by Jafar Pishvari. And there's a lot of debate still to this day over whether there was a genuine plan to succeed or not. In any event, once the Soviets withdraw support for this republic, it quickly falls apart and then is repressed by the Iranian army quite brutally. But this also did significant damage to the Tudeh party, because the Tudeh party was seen as publicly sort of supporting this independent or the establishment of this sort of Republic of Azerbaijan. So it was seen as supporting policy of succession on behalf of the Soviets, and also it had also previously, to the chagrin of and ire of many sort of Iranian nationalists, as advocating a concession in the north, an oil concession in the north, to basically counterbalance that of the British in the south. And we should obviously recall that Iran is very much, the south of Iran is pretty much the playground of the Anglo-Iranian oil company, and by extension the British government in many respects, and, you know, had its own internal security forces. It had sort of often drawn on the Bakhtiari tribes to basically implement security measures in the south of the country. So we do see an ongoing neo-colonial relationship, and we see the increasing importance in the politics of oil, particularly as obviously Churchill made the decision to switch the Royal Navy from coal to oil. So yeah, so Iran is occupied, and then obviously we have this 1946 crisis, which I mentioned. Truman ultimately gives an ultimatum to Stalin to withdraw, and ultimately that's a complex question in itself, how that comes about and who was responsible, which I won't get into. But in any event, the Soviets withdraw, that the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan quickly collapses, and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi sets about, you know, basically trying to, you know, reestablish his control over the country. In 1949, there's an assassination attempt, and this is pinned on the Tudeh party, and then he bans that party, but it remains active. But more importantly, and this is obviously a very significant episode in Iranian history, which I'm sure most people will be aware of, it's these... the rise to prominence once again. He was always a very significant figure, but the rise to prominence once again of Mohammad Mossadegh, who, you know, calls for and supports, has a leading role in the nationalization of the Anglo-Iranian oil company.
Poses a threat to peace, and the Middle East again becomes a trouble spot. as Iran's vast petroleum reserves aroused nationalists following seizure by the Iranian government of the British-operated refineries and distribution facilities. Demonstrations at the huge oil port of Abadan culminate in the tearing down of signs over company offices and the raising of the Iranian flag over the installations. Desperate mediation efforts are made as Britain appeals to the International Court in The Hague and receives a temporary injunction against the seizure. The printing office at Abadan is barred to the publisher of the daily newspaper, while Iranians are permitted to enter. Publication of the paper is suspended during the crisis. Compromise offers failing, the British cruiser, Mauritius, is ordered to the port to protect the lives of employees and their families. Meanwhile, preparations for closing down the refineries go forward as valves are closed to halt the intake of oil into the already overtaxed storage facilities. Tanker captains refuse to load oil and give receipts payable to Iran. Evacuation of women and children by air is stepped up as tension rises. 2,500 British employees are affected by the order, while the sick are flown out strapped to litters. Only key operating personnel remain to guard against fire in the highly combustible area. Despite the spreading nationalist sentiment, fanned by Iranian board member Hossein Maki, precautions are taken to prevent damage to the billion-dollar industry, pending further negotiation. In Abadan's 125 degrees of heat, the international situation is explosive.
And this obviously absolutely enrages the British. And this is 1951, during a Labour government, actually. And quickly thereafter, there are plans drawn up by the British to potentially invade Abadan and occupy it in the south of the country where the oil refineries are. So Mohammad Mossadegh becomes the prime minister in 1951, and prior to that, the National Front of Iran comes into being in 1949. It's sort of a coalition of various, you could say, liberal, nationalist, social democratic, maybe, forces who obviously are supposed to be supporting this initiative of nationalizing Iran's oil. And this is sort of the beginning, you might say, in the aftermath of the Second World War, of a new period of sort of decolonization, or calling, it was sort of anti-colonial struggles and fights, sort of various sort of battles against former colonial masters. So particularly obviously the French and the British empires, which I'll get to in a little bit. So Mohammad Mossadegh is a very, very important kind of figure, obviously, in Iranian history. He's seen as, you know, a great patriot, sort of Qajar lineage himself, sort of aristocratic background, trained in law in Switzerland, and was famously one of the few, very few, like a tiny handful of politicians who actually objected to Reza Khan crowning himself king, because he thought, Mossadegh thought, it would lead to sort of the establishment of a new despotism, which he was not wrong about. So yeah, so he becomes, you know, prime minister. The British immediately move to sort of snuff out that movement. They quickly embargo Iranian oil. They seek to isolate Iran in every single arena.
The Iranian oil crisis comes to America's shores as Premier Mohammad Mossadegh arrives in New York to plead his nation's case before the United Nations. Greeted by Entezam Nasrullah, now President of the General Assembly, the ailing Premier will remain in a hospital during his stay here, except for his appearance before the Security Council. While he explains Iran's expropriations of the huge British oil installations with its billion-dollar plant at Abadan, the last 300 British technicians are evacuated a day before the deadline set for their expulsion by the Iranian government. During the early days of the deadlock, British naval and paratroop forces were alerted in Iranian waters, but today the cruiser Mauritius serves as an evacuation vessel for the men who remained until the last minute during the bitter dispute. The oil men, who helped produce almost one-fifth of the world's petroleum supply, again find the protection of their flag. And with their departure, the whole free world faces two problems: that of a depleted oil supply and a possibility of a war-provoking incident in the Near East.
Mossadegh did take his case to the UN and the International Court of Justice and won. But nevertheless, the Labour Party is elected out of government in the UK and is replaced with the Conservatives, again, led by Churchill and Anthony Eden. Similarly, Truman is elected out, leaves office and is replaced by Dwight Eisenhower, and the Dulles brothers, who are equally quite infamous characters and obsessed with the Cold War and defeating the Soviets at any cost. And they basically see Mossadegh, this sort of liberal nationalist politician, as opening the door to communism in Iran, the risk or the danger that Iran could, scare quotes, fall to communism.
Iran's British-hating Premier Mossadegh arrives in Cairo, where he gets a rousing welcome by 20,000 British-hating Egyptians. But Iranians at home charge Mossadegh was snubbed because Egypt's premier didn't show up. Nevertheless, banners hail him as the destroyer of Britain. Mossadegh goes to a meeting with Egyptian officials, which brings a crowd-pleasing declaration of mutual friendship for each other and antagonism for the British. Then Mossadegh continues homeward.
So, as we all know, and this is obviously a very sort of important and decisive period in Iranian history, there's also debates, over this, and it's still being contested till today, what combination of domestic and external factors resulted in Mossadegh, so what could he have done to maybe have avoided this, etc. At the end of the day, he is overthrown by a coup d'etat orchestrated and supported by MI6 and the CIA, and the Shah is reinstalled because he had fled the country. He'd left the country of his own accord, even though Mossadegh apparently told him, not to, but begged him not to. He's reinstated, and the sort of Iranian oil then falls to a sort of international consortium, which then manages Iran's oil through to the 70s, basically. But yeah, so this is sort of an important juncture for various reasons. Obviously, this sort of liberal, some people call him, he's got a populist, but you could also say he had liberal aspects. He's a complex sort of figure, so had certain sort of liberal demeanor, but also populist instincts. Also, very much in this early stages, as I said, of decolonization and a sort of rebellion against former imperial powers or declining imperial powers, and very much calling for self-determination, very much calling for the right to control one's own resources and use them for the benefit of their own people. Obviously, because the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company had been infamous insofar as its accumulation of just obscene and exorbitant profits at the expense of the Iranian government, at the expense of Iranian development, at the expense of what many saw as the progress of the country. And this is obviously very important. And just to return obviously to the overthrow of Mossadegh, quickly thereafter we see sort of the violent repression of the Tudeh party in Iran. It's being sort of routed and rooted out, like decimated essentially within the country, as well as obviously various other sort of liberal nationalists, all stripes, all of those. And famously, Mossadegh's foreign minister, Hossein Fatemi, is executed.
Attention is focused once again on the Middle East, where events in Iran have taken a dramatic double twist. Forced to flee his palace in Tehran, the Shah and his queen arrive in Rome after an alleged attempt by the Imperial Guard to arrest Dr. Mossadegh and a refusal by the Shah to dissolve Parliament at Mossadegh's request. In Tehran, it looked as if Mossadegh would soon be named president, and on his orders, troops occupied the Shah's palaces and surrounded Parliament. And then the people themselves took a hand. Yeah! 300 killed and hundreds wounded is a conservative estimate. The rioters freed those taken prisoner earlier and stormed the house of Mossadegh. Foreign Minister Fatemi gets through. First reports that he was torn to pieces have not been confirmed. Meanwhile, the mob flocked the streets demanding the return of the Shah. Mossadegh and his government were swept from power in favor of General Zahidi, the man appointed by the Shah in the first place.
The thoughts of Britain instinctively turned to Abaddon, that monument to British enterprise and engineering skill. Forced to abandon what we had created in the wilderness, is it too much to hope that we shall see once more the tankers of Britain at Abaddon? Maybe sanity will yet prevail, and Iran and Britain go forward in harmony.
So, yeah, in the aftermath of the coup, we also see the United States support the formation and building up of the Iranian security apparatus, the apparatus that would be instrumental in, you know, succeeding decades for repressing any kind of political dissent, whether from the university to the mountains to the city square. And that's obviously the Savak, which is infamously known as the Savak, which had both external and internal departments, which were proved very effective and, as I said, were built up by the help of the CIA. And it was seen as obviously essential to do that, essential to do that to, again, in the fight against communism in the course of the Cold War. And many have sort of read this as, again, the American age of neocolonialism in Iran. And we see very much in this period increasingly analysis under the influence of developments in Latin America and theories of dependency and dependent capitalist development emerging in Iran, and obviously figuring Mohammad Reza Pahlavi very much in that genre as a client state of the United States.
Majesty, I am happy to welcome you to the United States on this, your first visit here. I've looked forward to your Majesty's visit with great pleasure, and I trust that during its course you may have the opportunity of becoming well acquainted with our country. I trust, too, that we may have the opportunity of acquiring through your Majesty a better knowledge of Iran, its heritage of greatness and culture, and the courage and farsightedness with which present-day Iran is led by your Majesty, is facing the problems of the modern world. Our two countries were partners in the struggle against fascism. The traditional friendship which bound us together during those troubled times has grown even stronger in the years since the war. Your Majesty's visit represents the high point of this relationship, which will, I'm sure, become still closer in the years ahead.
Sir President. It is with a deep feeling and emotion that I, for the first time, set foot on American soil here in the capital of the United States and in the presence of its chief executive. To visit the United States has been a wish I've long cherished. When you, Mr. inviting me to come here as your guest and as the guest of your government, you a message of warm regard and goodwill for Iran was privileged to be one of your allies and to contribute to the triumph of the cause of freedom in the Second World War. Allies in war, we shall likewise be privileged, I trust, to work with the United States in the maintenance of peace in the Middle East and in the achievement of liberty and prosperity as the aim of all freedom-loving people. I thank you, Mr. President, for your generous welcome. I'm looking forward with the keenest anticipation to all that I have to experience here in the greatest of the democracies in a free world.
You've come a long way to be with us, and we're very grateful. On behalf of the people of the United States, I bid you a most hearty welcome.
Even before coming here, I had seen and learned of the friendship of the United States for Iran. This friendship, the government and people of Iran reciprocate to the fullest degree. From them,